This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Our kids have said to us since we've moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, of values that, you know, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with two young kids.
See what makes Minnesota the star of the North. New residents share why they love calling it home at exploreminnesota.com/live.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. How often have you heard a person say that their boss doesn't understand the job that they do? Now, bosses have been the butt of jokes and unkind remarks as long as organizations have been around. But since the 1980s, more and more people, running companies and senior executives, have business degrees and MBAs, more so than actually having hands-on experience understanding the business they're managing. Our guest and her research describes the negative effects of unexpert leaders. We'll discuss the trend today here on America Trends.
With us on America Trends is Amanda Goodall, and she's written a new book called Credible: The Power of Expert Leaders. She's also a professor at the University of London. And this book is really about what it takes to run a company, a corporation, an organization. What kind of detail orientation should someone have as opposed to being a generalist? And what you tell us, Amanda, in the book is that there's been this sweep of time from the 1980s when we've gone to more of a generalist approach to those running these really important corporations and organizations, from one where somebody could have done it from the bottom up and really understood the innards and the mechanics of the organization and what it purports to do.
Hi, Larry. Yes, that's exactly right. Over the last sort of few decades, this idea of the post boy, and it might have been a boy 50 years ago, working their way up from the post to become CEO of the organization. I think that has really changed now. Now there's much more movement at the top of organizations, CEOs shifting around different kinds of firms. And sadly, I would say they're shifting across the kinds of organizations that they may know. So the sort of what I would call the generalist type of CEO, who years ago would have worked their way up an organization or at least stayed in an industry, we suddenly then got into this idea that it was okay to move from industry to industry as a CEO. And that idea was partially propagated by business schools, actually. I think we have to take some responsibility for that. The idea that if you do an MBA or you get a management kind of education, that gives you a set of tools that means that you can go anywhere with those tools. And of course, that's just not true. You really do need to understand the sector, the industry, and the organization. And I think our four sisters and brothers in the past would see it extraordinary that people are moving across industries in the way that they are today. And I think the evidence that I've tried to raise in my research and the stuff that's in the book shows that it's a big mistake.
Well, you do point out the fact that there are people who say, I'm going to be the head of this bank, And I'm so proud to tell you at the outset, at my first board meeting, I know nothing about banking. They take that and they wear that proudly, saying, I'm coming in from the outside, so I'm not limited by the thinking that has really permeated this building for the last 50 years. Why is that not a good thing, that outsider coming in?
Yes, exactly. That is an extraordinary story. So I think there's been a lot of things that have been mixed up, and I would argue that headhunters have partly contributed to this thinking. Headhunters really want as many people as they can on their list when they post, whether it's internal managers or CEOs at any level. The obvious people for an industry or a company that they know, they don't need a headhunter, and headhunters are used to bringing kind of outsiders in. And I would blame them actually for some of this, if not all of it. And yeah, what's happened is that people coming from outside, there's been this idea that if you want to change something in an organization or a sector, that somehow the people inside it don't have any clues about what else is going on in the outside world. It's just this kind of very 0-1 attitude, which has permeated so much of sort of management and leadership thinking, specifically around appointments, that because you're inside an organization, you can't possibly know what's going on outside. I find that extraordinary. I'll tell you another area that I think has contributed to this kind of way of thinking is management consulting firms. Mm-hmm. The management consulting firm helps them if this idea of having external advisors, that's how they exist. And let's look at Deloitte. It's like the fifth largest private company in the United States now. That hasn't helped either, this idea that people from outside can help. Now, what I will point to you at actually is, let's turn the lens on the management consulting firms themselves and look at Deloitte, McKinsey, KPMG, etc. Look at their leadership. You will find that these major consulting firms have been practicing expert leadership for the whole of their existence, and they haven't changed when everyone else has changed. Still, if you look at the very senior people in these firms, the people that get to the very top are almost entirely, with the odd exception, people who dropped out of a womb in the basement, and they have worked all the way up. They've become experts in the field of consulting and management consulting, and they know great deal about the industry, and that's how they get to the top. They would never call on some nurse or an engineer from, you know, shipbuilding to come and give them advice about their firm. And yet, for some reason, we've all found it's okay for a management consulting firm to go in an organization and give advice to people who have probably got much better informed ideas. So I think these factors have really changed thinking, and I really want to push back on this. And I know it's quite hard doing that. A lot of people say to me that my research is counterintuitive, and I say, really? It's counterintuitive to want a hairdresser to run a hair salon? You really think that's counterintuitive?
Well, let me ask you this. What is leadership then? What is good management? Because you know yourself, there are many good practitioners, and you do talk a lot in the book about the healthcare industry. There are a lot of physicians, let's say, who should never run a hospital. Now, maybe it is better for somebody who's got that kind of background to do it ultimately, but not everyone is cut out to be a leader or a manager.
Exactly, and that's true. And in fact, I gave a talk just a couple of days ago to this investment bank. You know, the question that the CEO posed before I talked to the staff was, we have this issue where we are mainly full of technical experts, investment experts, and we get told by our staff if we put someone in front of them who is a technical expert like them, often they don't understand the people they're working with. Some of them even say they don't like people, etc. But if we put someone who doesn't understand what they're doing, then that really doesn't work out at all well. So the truth is that if I went out on the street right now and just randomly plucked some person on the pavement and did a kind of test on whether they might be a good manager or leader, I'm going to find probably exactly the same, if not more, that the generalist is just as prone to not being a good manager or leader than the expert. And yet this is another kind of narrative that we've allowed to permeate our world, which is experts are intrinsically bad managers and leaders. I hear that all the time. Now, if I look at the data from many of the studies that I've done, which often predate, you know, the kind of the things that we understand now about leadership and management skills and emotional intelligence, etc. If I look at this old data, I see that actually despite not having an awareness about those things, these organizations are still outperformed by people who are technical experts. Now, today, we recognize that we need behavior is one of the most important things. And on our course that I set up for doctors, medical doctors, physicians, the first thing we do is hold a mirror up to them. And I say to them, you can be a great clinician. You can be brilliant at finance and we can teach you strategy. But if you're an asshole, it isn't going to work. And I think where I will concede is someone who is focused in intensely in an area and become a specialist. Yes, you have to pull them back and they have to widen their lens. Now, we want that specialist to be a brilliant technician, whether it's an engineer, a lawyer, a doctor, whatever, you know, or a care home worker. We want people to really know what they're doing well. And then what we need to do is pull them back, widen the lens, give them some training, support them into a leadership and management role. They need that support. And often they're just neglected because we permeate this myth that experts can't be leaders and managers. So if we change that kind of mindset and realize it's about spotting them, it's about developing them, about recognizing, you know, who they are and what they bring. And I say that because in the discussion that I had this week, I kind of said, you know, we have this awful cliched idea about the techie, the person sitting in a corner with a hoodie on, he doesn't really want to talk to anyone. And I kind of think, you know, how much about that cliche is created by the people, you know, outside of that person? If we actually converse with that person, if we actually said to that person, I love the way you communicate, I love the way you look at people in the eyes when you're talking, et cetera, et cetera. If we started to treat them like managers and, you know, started to change our behavior towards them, there's no reason why they wouldn't necessarily reciprocate. But they're conforming to a kind of stereotype. And we're sort of also conforming to a stereotype in allowing them in that role. So I would say we need to shake things up and kind of go back to basics and recognize that particularly today, we really do need experts to be able to take the reins in leadership and management positions. And I'm very happy to talk about why. If you're interested.
Yeah, I do want to talk about this. The fact that in America, at least, the whole financialization of business, where a lot of the middle people who are there adding, I don't know if they're adding value, but they're adding costs. For example, private equity and these managers who seem to run everything into the ground. They don't seem to know much about any of the businesses that they actually are purchasing, and they don't care. Because they're taking a short-term view. They want to squeeze what they can out of it in fees and the like, and they want to move on from there. Now, you say that expert leaders opt for a more sustainable long view, and you know that we have this criticism in America that everything is based on short-term results, quarterly reports. How do you look at those two things squaring as to the types of people who are now leading many of the companies that you bemoan the fact that they're leading?
Yes, absolutely. The research, I haven't done research myself showing that they necessarily take the long view. But what I have done is I've looked at other people's research. And you can see that there's various signals. People who are more likely to invest in R&D, people from within an industry, people who have been in an industry for a long time, that signals that they're investing in R&D. They must be taking the long view because everyone knows that research and development takes a long time to come to fruition. We know that people who are generalist CEOs, and this is again other people's research, are more likely to move around from organization to organization. And they also subsequently, actually because of that, really consequently, have much higher salaries than people who stick with an industry and work their way up. They've learned to push the salary up, and some of the, you know, the difference between some CEO salaries and the average employee salaries have now just gone through the roof. Commit some examples of sort of, you know, whether it's Mr. Honda, you know, who's now died, who set up his own industry, his own lab and looking at research and then motorbikes and then cars, you know, just after the war. You know, he was with that company right up until he died, and he still tested stuff right up until he retired. So I think the people who are really committed to a field, really interested in a field, want to stay in that field. There's an intrinsic value for them. It doesn't mean they're not extrinsically motivated. It doesn't mean that they don't want money as well, and they wouldn't mind a decent salary. Of course they do. We all know that professionals want to be paid. But there's a greater intrinsic motivation to make that industry, that whatever it happens to be, that product, to make that work over the long view. So I think that there is a really good case suggesting that experts are way more likely to stay in the industry and take the long view. And that, as you say, quarterly returns, all the short-termism. And in a world which is suffering from climate change now, we really do need to start taking the long view.
Amanda Goodall is our guest. The book is called Credible, The Power of Expert Leaders. What do you say to those critics who might say, well, maybe you don't understand that there are a lot of companies now that are conglomerates? And I'll give you one in my home state of Connecticut. For years, a gentleman by the name of Harry Gray ran United Technologies. And United Technologies made everything from engines to air conditioning to elevators. They owned all these different types of companies. Obviously, he was not an expert in everything. Elevators, I guess he knew they went up and down, like their share prices, I'm sure. But tell me, what do you say to people who say, well, maybe that's old thinking because look at these conglomerates? How do you respond to that?
Well, I think conglomerates is an interesting one, and I'm not an expert in this area, but we've all seen that the world has gone through massive fashions, either outsourcing or buying lots of different companies that are unrelated to your industry. And what happens often in those, there's lots of failures around that from Boeing and various other companies, certainly ones I know in the UK. But also this idea that a company just bought loads of unrelated companies, that went through a trend, didn't it? And then the whole market contracted and people started to go back to the core business again. It hasn't been something that's kept going. Now, it doesn't mean that there aren't some conglomerates that have got businesses in related areas. I would say that industry is accepted now and we know this, there's loads of mergers and acquisitions evidence, lots of it, again, not my research, but actually stuff done in my business school, showing that mergers and acquisitions are more likely to work when the CEO of the acquiring company has got expertise and knowledge in the industry of the company that is being merged or acquired. There's lots of evidence to show that as well. So I think I get a lot of flack for this partly because there's a lot more generalists out there than experts and because there is this fashion to sell generalism. But I think increasingly people have recognized actually that you need some kind of internal, some kind of knowledge. And one thing that's really important about this actually is it's not just at the CEO level. So the area that I've done quite a lot of research on is in the line manager level. Your boss, you really want a boss who knows what you do in your job. And that we've got all sorts of results showing that it leads to greater job satisfaction and why it leads to greater job satisfaction and lower propensity to quit your job also. Now, that's important because that we also know from lots of studies, and they've been big quantitative studies and experimental research, also, one's using big data and one's in experiments, showing that happy workers are more productive workers. So this is an effect that's happening inside the organization with line managers and working up to the organization. Why is it so important to have bosses who are experts at the top and inside the organization? Number one, people who recognize the importance of core business at the top of an organization are going to recognize also that it's important in the key departments of that organization to have people who are outstanding experts in those roles. And those people as line managers, we also know, line managers have the biggest, bosses have the biggest effect on employee job satisfaction. We've done this in our own research using US and UK data, that the effect of a boss on job satisfaction is double the effect of your remuneration, of your pay, which is extraordinary. When I saw that result, I was blown away. And we also know that having an expert boss contributes massively to job satisfaction. And job satisfaction, as I said before, is important because it leads to more productive workers. Now, expert bosses are more likely to recognize that they need to have expert line managers in organizations as well.
Now, let me ask you this. You talk about sports, for example, and you talk about the NBA, Formula One, and others. But let me give you an example because you had it in the book. You talk about Pat Summitt from the University of Tennessee, who was really the reigning leader of women's basketball in America at the collegiate level for a long time. But she has been surpassed. She's now, you know, deceased. But Gino Auriemma from the University of Connecticut really superseded her accomplishments with 11 national titles. And the question is, Gino was never a great athlete. He's about 5'6". He is not someone who had the bona fides that she had. Do you worry that every time you give an example about an expert doing this, that someone who's got this background that is something of an anomaly comes along and proves otherwise?
Yeah, this is great. And it is great with sport. I can tell you that I've done not that many job interviews as an academic, but the ones that I have done, every single time football comes up, soccer comes up, you know, because everyone's, you know, massively into soccer in this country, and the same across all sports. People get irate in sport. And I suppose there's two reasons why I like sports data. Number one is, in organizations, as you're probably aware, outcome measures can be manipulated. Performance can be manipulated, and it is regularly for those quarterly returns that you mentioned before. One thing I like about sports is that you either win or you don't. I can measure, because of all these wonderful enthusiasts in sports, I can find data across sports that, you know, down to really minutiae detail because these enthusiasts collect it. So I can look at all the kind of income, the variables around leadership in precise detail. And then I can look at outcome measures as well. You either win or you don't, as I said. So I think sports data is really good because it also, we get, in a sense, even more carried away with sports data because we love, you know, our sports. And so we get really passionate about it. We lose any sense of objectivity. And I suppose for me, the research that I do came out of working with leaders, watching these leaders, one, you know, in Chicago and two in the UK. And I saw that they behaved differently. And from that came my hypotheses. And then my desire to try and replicate that finding of expert bosses across lots of different fields. And I did that because I kind of silly thing that I often say when I'm giving talks. I say, if you randomly stop someone in the street and you hauled them over to your clipboard and said, "Madam, excuse me, can you tell me what you exactly know to be true about leaders and managers?" I don't know what they'd say. They might say, "Well, we know we don't want a narcissistic idiot to lead our country." And then I'd have to say, "Well, in that case, we leadership researchers have really failed." But that's the point, is that there's been hundreds and thousands of books and articles, you know, on leadership. But what is actually known? Now, my research does not explain everything. There will always be outliers, and there will be outliers anyway. In anything we do, there's always outliers. But at least what I can say is that, yes, you're going to find the odd soccer manager who didn't play very good football or didn't play at all. But on the whole, I feel confident that this pattern around expert leaders in sports, in the sports I've looked at only, and in businesses is as strong as I can suggest to be true. I feel the data is not lying. Now, does it explain everything? No, it doesn't. It only explains a fraction of leadership and performance. But it's a pattern that I feel is reliable and, in that case, generalizable. And that was always important to me. But yes, of
very
course,
interesting.
Alongside Arsene Wenger, who, in my world of football, who doesn't, you know, necessarily fit the role.
Like Ted Lasso. Now, let me ask you this. You talk a bit in the book, thankfully, about politics. We have to get to that. First of all, a politician who rises to the top of their game, if you will, and you talked about Elizabeth Truss, the PM, for about a day in the UK. You talk about the moron premium. Can you describe that and then bring it across the pond to us in the United States? Because you alluded to what has happened here with Donald Trump, who really was taking that to a new extreme. I never was in government. I never was on the board of works in my local town, and I want to be the president of the United States. Help us to understand this leap of faith.
Yes, I mean, it is a very sad state, I think, that the world is in right now. And I suppose it's not my research, but I would look to others' research, which I've, you know, the books that I've looked at. And this shift away from respecting expertise, and there was a very famous statement made by a politician in this country around Brexit, you know, where he suggested that British people were tired of experts. And, you know, experts said at the time that Brexit really won't work for the country, and unfortunately that has been, you know, proven now, and the majority of people in this country now see that. But it's a sad division, and I think partially it's a representation of what's happened in society in terms of the hollowing out of jobs, in terms of the kind of knowledge workers who were maybe the minority versus a kind of larger pool of people who are being manipulated by politicians. And I just, this idea of the death of expertise, which isn't my expression, I think has got a lot to do with it. Social media, you know, there's so many different areas where I feel expertise and people's voices have been kind of drowned out or been equalized. You know, the voice of an expert against a non-expert have been treated identically. And this is, unfortunately, and there's other people who can speak much clearer than I can to this, but this is something that I've observed, certainly. And in a way, it's kind of, I even find it, as I said, in organizations. Someone said to me in this investment bank, but there's many more generalists than there are experts. And I've mentioned that already, but that's the truth. And in a sense, I think that is part of this whole thing as well. But I get a feeling now with AI, I think AI has really scared people, and they realize that actually we really need experts to A, control it, regulate it, understand it, etc. So I wonder right now whether some things will change, a bit like during COVID when suddenly doctors, you know, were thrust to the front of organizations when they weren't necessarily pre-COVID. I wonder whether we might have more of respect for experts in the future. And I'm certainly getting approached by people who are suggesting this idea. Now, well, only time will tell, but I'm kind of hopeful. And also the recognition around climate change. I just wonder, I mean, we may have to hit a lower low before that happens. That's the only thing that I would say. And this is me speaking as a non-expert in these areas, but I hope it gives you something.
Well, let me talk about the physician as expert and giving credence to what they say and expecting that what we get from them is expert and not elitist. And we still have a politician in America today who keeps railing about Dr. Anthony Fauci. Yet you talk in the book about the fact that he really was vaunted and therefore was protected. Donald Trump did not try to fire him. And yet Ron DeSantis, who's running for the Republican nomination, keeps talking about Dr. Fauci in the most derogatory terms, as if his expertise was something that no politician who has no medical background should have ever yielded to in the midst of the crisis. So what do you say about that?
Think about it in a couple of ways in the book. I don't go deep into it, but I think what was interesting in this country, and I can speak particularly to this country, and also there's an interesting story about Canada, actually. Canada had this fantastic warning system for global viruses. I mean, it was a world leader. It was a world leader in that field. And it got dismantled literally as COVID was knocking at the door. And it got taken over by generalists, or the epidemiologists left, and blah, blah, blah. I go into detail in the book about that. And they really messed up because of this. So the experts were taken down, and it cost them a lot more money. Now, the thing that also happened in our country was we did the same in Britain. Boris Johnson at first didn't want to acknowledge that galloping over the hills was this virus coming, and there had been a lot of deaths in its wake already in Italy and in China. He didn't want to recognize that. So in the end, when it slapped him in the face, because a lot of people were really dying, he then had to kind of quickly grab an expert, public health expert, thrust them into the, you know, into center stage. And then I would suggest that actually what happened in our country was that there was a little bit of groupthink. There was a committee put together. It's called SAGE, and it's a committee of kind of experts who were directing the country at that time once we recognized that we had a pandemic. And actually, funnily enough, that I would say that it wasn't diverse enough in terms of experts. I would say that there was no economist on there looking at the cost-benefit analysis of some of the policies that were being practiced, and actually looking at, well, if we shut schools for this amount of time, what's going to be the knock-on effect both on the economy, but also psychiatrists talking about what's the knock-on effect on children. None of that stuff was thought about because we put all our eggs in the public health basket. If we'd thought about this carefully in the long run and we had a team together, and now we're going through an inquiry on this, which you, I don't know whether you've gone through it yourselves in the States, but
no.
I think we'll be more prepared next time and recognize that actually, you know, you need experts in there, but you also do need a group of experts. You don't just want one expert dictating everything, because public health people, naturally, you know, they're dictated to keep everyone off the streets, keep everyone away. And we used to have arguments, me and my husband, who is an economist, about well, we need other voices in here. And if you lock everyone away, what happens when the economy crashes? And our economy is in tatters. And a lot of that is because of Brexit, because of COVID and Brexit, but also post-COVID, it's been bad. So I think experts in hospitals, what was great here, though, was that doctors really were thrust into the you know, front line and given power that they hadn't had before in the NHS, I would argue.
Well, our guest in the book poses the question, should a doctor run a hospital, an engineer, a tech company? Workers do seem to value the skill and knowledge that someone has about the core business. I think one of the points that you make in the book is so important, that these expert leaders, they bring with them a sense of responsibility to the profession itself, not to the bottom line only. And that this really is such an important thing, particularly now when ethics and integrity are so much on the line, I think, in so many professions. Who can you trust? And I think going forward, as you say, with the issues that we're facing, like climate change and the like, we better find people who we really value their expertise, and not shun it, not give it away and say, well, you know, just because you have an opinion makes it equally valid to that of an expert. I don't know why we would give that away when people work their whole lives to attain that measure of success and credentializing, why we would throw that away in these critical times.
Exactly, Larry. I couldn't agree with you more. And also, just to throw something in about the bottom line, you know, just talking about hospitals, the Mayo Clinic, the Cleveland Clinic, these are the most successful hospitals in world rankings, year in, year out, in America rankings and in world rankings, year in, year out. They are making a lot of money. They are incredibly successful. The nice thing for a social scientist like me is that they have only ever been led by doctors, by physicians. From the outset, they've been led by physicians, but they are incredibly successful organizations and they make a lot of money as well. So, you know, as you say, it's about the credibility. It's about the security for employees, but let's not forget that they also lead to successful organizations.
Absolutely. Let me ask you in closing about an anomaly that we have here in America by the name of Elon Musk. And he didn't know a lot about cars, and he didn't know a lot about social media. One, he built into a big company with a lot of subsidy from the government, which people don't talk about. But the second, he's driving right into the ground. And, of course, he's into space as well. What does he say to you about what it is you're sharing with us in the book, Credible?
Well, it's interesting because I've looked at Musk quite a bit because he's people raised him as an example. And the thing about him is interesting that he did get into Stanford, that he came from a kind of engineering start in life. And he also worked in a battery organization or some firm that made energy storage type things. I think it was batteries. So he wasn't completely green to the field. Now, admittedly, building cars, he was green to, obviously, but the concept of batteries and electricity and that wasn't completely. Now, I would say, in contrast, when it comes to Twitter, he didn't know a thing about that at all. And I think we can see that in that bottom line as compared to the other bottom line. But you're right. People could say to me, he's a bit of an outlier. But I would say that he did start somewhat in the energy, you know, side of it, and he got into Stanford in engineering. You know, that's not an easy thing to do. So he wasn't as green at that as he certainly is about social media.
Absolutely. What do you say about the Peter principle, that we've heard for so many years, somebody rising to the level of their ultimate incompetence?
Yes, it's a very popular thing to argue, actually, and I'm not sure I agree with that necessarily, and I don't quite know if I would. I mean, I suppose it depends what kind of competence that we're looking at. People like to use that a bit with experts, but I think if experts are actually trained in the other skills of leading and management, then I think they could grow beyond that perceived competence. So I'm not sure I'm a big fan of that. And in fact, we did a study where we actually talked about that, but to be honest, I can't remember the details of that study, so you might have to cut that bit out. So.
Okay, well, this is great. I really appreciate the time that you've taken to share the contents of this book, Credible, The Power of Expert Leaders, Amanda Goodall. It's a really interesting read, and it will be food for thought going forward as we're selecting leaders ourselves and as we watch how companies are performing and many of us investing in them. Very important considerations all. Thank you for being with us today here on America Trends.
Thank you, Larry. I really enjoyed it.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Our kids have said to us since we've moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, of values that, you know, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with two young kids.
See what makes Minnesota the Star of the North. New residents share why they love calling it home at exploreminnesota.com/live.